Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the United States v. Aslan et al. Mr. Brindley.
May it please the Court. My name is Beau Brindley, and I represent the defendant appellant, Mihai Panaitescu. Mr. Panaitescu brings before the Court one issue related to his sentencing, and that issue is whether the district court erred by finding that Mr. Panaitescu's previous sentence in United States v. Moloman was discharged for purposes of the Guideline Section 5G 1.3 analysis. To make this determination, the Court used a document produced by the Bureau of Prisons after the alleged discharge dates had passed, and this document gave a projection of when the discharge should have occurred. This Court in United States v. Cruz indicated that for purposes of this analysis, discharge is determined by release from custody. That's the determining factor.
But Mr. Brindley, it was my understanding that at Mr. Panaitescu's initial appearance on December 22, 2006, he was ordered detained pending trial in this case.
He was given a detention order that was based upon the prior order that had been issued in the Moloman case.
But there's a detention order. That's my point.
Is.
And so as... So I'm not sure what prejudice may have accrued to him by the Bureau of Prisons' failure to notify him that the reason for his detention changed from being the earlier conviction to the detention order in this case. He wasn't going anywhere of the end of that.
I agree, Your Honor. He was not going anywhere. However, in order for the sentence to be discharged, I think some action must occur. Simply
Why?
The passage of time isn't sufficient to discharge a sentence.
But that gets us to the appeal waiver, because whether there was an error or not in running the sentence consecutively or concurrently to something is really part of the manner of determining the sentence. The guidelines address it, 5G 1.3, and there's a waiver.
There is a waiver which indicates that he waives all issues with respect to the calculation of the sentence, to the sentence imposed, and the method it was calculated.
And the manner, and part of the imposition of a sentence is the determination whether it's going to be consecutive or concurrent. The point of a waiver is even if there's a mistake, you promise not to raise it.
That's correct. But the waivers, as this Court has found, are construed strictly against the government. It is our position.
Are you really arguing that your appeal is about his sentence in the first appeal, in the first case?
The sentence in the first case and whether it was discharged.
Are you raising a collateral attack on that?
No.
Sentence in this proceeding?
No, not at all. What I'm indicating here is at the sentencing for the instant case, the Court made a finding regarding the status of a previous case, and no information about that previous case was contained in the appellate waiver. And so making that finding with respect to whether that previous case was discharged was making a finding that was outside the scope of the waiver that he entered when he entered his plea in this case.
So, bottom line, what you are doing is trying to take advantage of a paperwork omission by the BOP.
Yes, because I believe that by failing to notify him or tell him that his sentence had been discharged in any way under the guidelines, I don't think that meets the definition of what discharge would be. A discharge doesn't occur passively. Somebody has to happen to discharge this man from custody.
But all that is to say, if you're right, that this should have been a concurrent sentence, not a consecutive sentence. There's nothing that bumps into statutory maxima. There's nothing else allegedly wrong.
That's correct, Your Honor. The only issue is that the district court believed that it could not consider a concurrent sentence because of the issue of discharge, which is based on this document that it is our position simply cannot possibly discharge a sentence because it was produced after the fact. All the document could do is say when it should have been discharged, but not when it was.
Basically, it seems you're arguing that he was owed a bond hearing on the new charges when he finished the first sentence.
Yes, a renewed bond hearing to see if the conditions were changed,
but
yes.
You've completely ignored the government's noting that he was taken before a magistrate when the new charges were filed, where he waived his right to a detention hearing, and the court granted the government's motion to detain him pending trial on the new charges. I'm just at a loss as to your argument.
Sure. It's my position that when this discharge was supposed to have occurred, he was entitled as a matter of right to a renewed bond hearing to see if the conditions had changed, and that didn't happen.
Why? Yeah. I have no idea where you get that from, since he's already waived his right to a detention hearing.
Because he has to, it is our position that he has to have notice that his sentence has been discharged somehow, and no notice was given. Some action needs to be taken.
Why,
other than the
if
time
nothing
passing.
Is going to happen, why couldn't they just give him notice later?
Why couldn't they give him notice
yeah,
later?
I mean, because there's no change in where he's living. There's no change in the detention status. There's no change at all. And yes, as Judge Rovner says, there's a paperwork flaw, perhaps on BOP's part, but I just don't see the prejudice.
Well, Your Honor, it is our position that the discharge can't occur without some action being taken. It can't occur passively as a matter of definition. And with that, I reserve any time I have left. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Brindley. Mr. Lopez?
Good morning, Your Honors. Please, the Court, Joseph Lopez on behalf of Mr. Dimitru. My issue is a little bit different, Your Honors. My issue deals with the foreseeability of conduct of others in fashioning a sentencing and calculating the number under the guidelines. In this case, it's clear that the defendant was directly responsible for defrauding 33 victims and received approximately $99,000. At sentencing, prior counsel argued that he should only be held responsible for those items because the conduct of the others was not reasonably foreseeable. In the interim, since I had filed my brief, this court in United States versus Salim at 597 F3rd 877 was looking at a similar issue in regard to foreseeability and determining the scope of the criminal activity which is undertaken by the defendant.
But that actually is the point I wanted to raise with you. Looking at your brief, it appears to me that your focus is exclusively on the foreseeability point. That's your argument. The district court committed clear error in finding that the conduct was reasonably foreseeable. The Salem case, or Salim, or however it's supposed to be pronounced, is discussing the scope of the jointly undertaken activity, which is a different question from foreseeability.
I think
so. I don't see you as raising a scope issue here.
Well, I think in order to get to the foreseeability, you have to discuss the scope. What is the scope of his jointly undertaken activity? And if it is such, then what is reasonably foreseeable to the individual at sentencing?
I think two separate questions, though. I mean, if you concede the scope, you could still argue about foreseeability, for example. You could say, yes, here's the scope of this particular conduct. It's so many years long. It involves so many people and so on, so many countries or whatever, but you could still be arguing foreseeability. I'm not sure that you have preserved an argument on scope.
Well, on page 9, I did indicate that his jointly undertaken criminal activity was limited in its scope, because I talk about a little bit of the scope and whether he cared if the broader scheme worked or not.
Yeah, but the government has argued that you waived any argument about the scope of jointly undertaking criminal activity, and that you limited your arguments below to reasonable foreseeability. So, I mean, would you concede that you're limited on appeal to the question of reasonable foreseeability?
Well, it's hard for me to concede something because I didn't do the sentencing, as the court knows, and I am with the record. But again, I think that the foreseeability argument and what the scope of the agreement is are kind of hand in hand, because in order to get the foreseeability, you really have to discuss the scope that the individual makes this agreement. I mean, you're agreeing with other co-conspirators.
But the problem, I mean, that's actually one thing we criticized the district court judge for in the Salem case. conflating those two tightly, because the kind of evidence that you would present on either issue is a bit different, and perhaps one might even say there's a plain error argument, except I didn't really see you raising it in the brief here in anything but in the most casual way.
And again, my brief goes to the foreseeability, the limited participation.
Maybe you should just argue foreseeability because I don't think you have a scope argument.
Well, in that instance, again, as far as the foreseeability is concerned, and even in the Saline case, this court discussed the Studley case, which is out of the Second Circuit, which is employing a multi-factor test, which I think is really, and I'm not criticizing the court, but I think is really a pretty good analysis when you're looking at this particular issue, is what factors should the court look at in order to make a determination as to whether or not this individual should be held responsible for conduct of others.
Well, and, you know, I mean, if you take a look at the government's brief, they're arguing that he ought to be held liable certainly for the conduct of Mulliman, Hahn, and himself, that would be enough to support the amount of loss and number of his victims at issue. Would you agree that the conduct of Mulliman and Hahn was reasonably foreseeable to Dimitro? Because if so, any error about the other co-schemers, would be harmless.
I will not concede that. Okay. I will not concede that because, again, I have to go back to the other argument that what's the scope of the jointly undertaken criminal activity to make that determination. And I see that I'm out of time, so I will reserve whatever time I have left for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lopez. Ms. Winston?
May it please the Court, my name is Sylvia Winston, and I represent the defendant appellant, Adrian Fischetti. Mr. Fischetti raised three arguments on appeal. He contested his convictions for aggravated identity theft and also for money laundering, and he also raised several sentencing errors. The government has conceded that the aggravated identity theft conviction was an error and that it should be vacated. Therefore, I'm going to concentrate most of my argument on the money laundering conviction. And if I have time, I'll address some sentencing issues. I do want to say a quick point about sentencing, though. There's no question that the sentencing will be remanded. The government has conceded that the district court needs to reevaluate the sentence and determine the scope of jointly undertaken activity. However, I would argue that it needs to be remanded to a different district court judge, and also that judge needs to take a fresh look at the sentence.
Could you just quickly say which other factors other than scope you think need another look?
Yes.
Obviously, the remand could be either plenary or focused.
Yes. Particularly, Mr. Fischetti raised the argument with regard to his enhancement for possessing a weapon in connection with this offense. We don't think that, A, the district court made a finding that the government proved by preponderance of the evidence that he possessed a weapon. And we also argued that there was no evidence that he possessed a weapon in connection with this offense.
You know, the government pointed out in Mr. Fischetti's sentencing memorandum that Fischetti himself relied on the numbers on the government's version of the crime and the government's spreadsheets. If that's correct, how would that not be waiver?
Well, I think that addresses another issue that we raised with regard to the sentence.
I know, but you only have 2 minutes left.
Which goes to our objection to the court not specifically finding that evidence was reliable. Mr. Fischetti, I don't know if you guys know, had 9 different trial counsel at the trial district court level. They were coming in at several different times. He would argue that he did not waive that argument, that even though one of his counsel may have relied on that spreadsheet, the district court still has to find that it's at least reliable information, still has to prove that the government proved by a preponderance of the evidence the calculations with regard to the loss amount and the number of victims.
Were you one of the nine?
I was not. We were appointed to represent him on appeal.
Let me jump in about the other point that you wanted to raise, which has to do with the money laundering. Santos, as you know, dealt with the promotion aspect of the money laundering statute, whereas the part that Mr. Fischetti is dealing with is the concealment part. And as I understand it, the money that he is being held responsible for is the number of dollars that were transmitted to Romania. It wasn't whatever it was, the 20% that he was holding back or whatever the percentage was. And so for purposes of the concealment prong, why isn't that measure of the funds sent out of the country to Romania in this instance a perfect measure of the amount that he's trying to conceal? In other words, isn't this business about net versus gross not helpful for the concealment part of the statute?
I would have to respectfully disagree with that.
But what are we going to net out of the dollars that he sent to Romania? Are we worried about what the Romanian people did with it once they got it?
Well, this court in United States v. Lee, which came out recently in 2010, the court stated, we did clarify and confirm that the statute does indeed prohibit both concealment of net proceeds and the reinvestment of net proceeds to promote the illicit activity. Based on that reason, we don't think there is a distinction between previous cases that have evaluated the promotional prong of the money laundering statute and this case, which is now looking at the concealment prong.
But why aren't, by not including the amount that he kept as his cut, why isn't that effectively, if you want to say it, a way of conceiving net proceeds? He's not being held responsible for the full amount of the money that he took, he and his delegates, if you will, from the various Western Union orders. It's only the amount that, as I understand, I mean, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that the amount that he was being held responsible for was the money that was being transmitted back to Romania.
You are correct. He is responsible. He is being held accountable for the money that he is transmitting to Romania.
So that nets it out. His part isn't being included.
Well, the way the government charged this case, they didn't prove or present any evidence that the money that he kept as commission, that he reinvested that or tried to conceal that money.
Right, and he's not being held responsible for that. He's only the money laundering part, maybe under other aspects of the indictment. But on the money laundering, I thought the amount was the part that he got rid of, the part that he paid back to the foreign co-schemers.
Yes, I agree with you. That was the amount he was held accountable for. But, again, we would argue that the concealment prong and the government not showing that was net profits that he transferred to the Romanians, that was plain error because under this circuit's precedents, including the most recent case, Lee, the court stated that under both prongs you have to show net profits. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Winston. Ms. Zindel?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Stephanie Zindel, and I represent the United States. I'd like to start by addressing Fiquette's conviction for money laundering. That conviction was not the result of plain error. This court has held that when the law is not clear and not settled, the conviction cannot be plain error.
You know, I really am concerned about the double jeopardy implications of the money laundering conviction. Is there any part of the money laundering conviction that is not covered by the wire fraud? Because the acts that you're calling money laundering seem to me to simply have been the last step, the final step in the wire fraud. I mean, there's a lot of overlap there.
The money laundering crimes in this case involve the transmission of the proceeds of the crime outside of the United States. Those are separate and apart from the money that Fiquette and his other co-schemers were picking up here in the United States. And because this
is it an inbound-outbound distinction you're suggesting? The wire fraud is the inbound and
The way it was charged in this case, the wire fraud, was the money that was being picked up here in the United States from the victims of the crime.
So you wouldn't have charged money laundering if they had just divided those funds up all amongst themselves and never sent them back to Romania?
I'm not positive what the government would have charged in that scenario, Your Honor. That is not the scenario here because the government charged concealment money laundering. And what makes these convictions different is that because they were concealment money laundering, the government had to prove that the money that was transmitted abroad was transmitted at least in part to conceal the true nature and source of those funds. And that's what helps to eliminate the merger problem that has concerned this court and the Supreme Court in Shalaba and Santos.
Could we be, really simplistic? And could you tell me what are some of the elements to the money laundering that are not also part of the wire fraud? Maybe then that would help me.
That would be the transmitting and transferring the funds outside of the United States in order to conceal their nature. That is different from wire frauds that were picked up here in the United States. The simple fact that the money laundering was involved in this larger scheme does not mean it's not a separate crime. A large scheme can entail multiple different crimes. For example, in this case, there was wire fraud and receipt of stolen funds, and also the money laundering. When the money laundering and the transactions that make up money laundering are not a normal part of the underlying scheme, they can be charged separately as concealment money laundering.
Why would you say it wasn't a normal part of the underlying scheme when that was the whole scheme to send it to Romania?
Perhaps in this scheme, that was one of the parts of the scheme, but it's not a normal part of a fraud scheme that co-schemers conceal money and hide that money, hide its true nature and source by sending it abroad. That is distinct.
I've seen 100 such cases.
And certainly it may be a part of a particular fraud scheme, but it's not like in the case of an illegal gambling operation in which the payment of expenses is a normal part of that sort of a business-like operation.
It seems to me like you're giving way too much away. I mean, because here you have wire fraud, and what's necessary for wire fraud could be entirely internal to the United States. You could tell people on Craigslist or eBay or whatever site you want that you're going to sell them a painting, and so they send their money to Western Union or to PayPal or whoever they send it to, and then you never send the painting. So you collected their money. That's it. I mean, you've already finished wire fraud at that point, I think.
That is correct, Your Honor.
You've defrauded them, so it doesn't matter whether you then turn around and go out on a binge or whether you buy real estate or whether you send the money to Romania or whatever you do with the money. You finished the wire fraud as of the moment that you fraudulently collected the money from the person.
That is correct, Your Honor, and that's why there is a distinction here. And additionally, there's the distinction that this money was sent abroad in order to conceal its funds, to make it harder for the government to detect the other underlying wire fraud and the other actions involved in this scheme, and harder to trace the individuals. This money was being sent abroad using alias identifications that were only used for short periods of time in order to avoid detection, or by using smaller individuals who were not larger players in the scheme, so that the sending of the money abroad would not get detected and that the underlying nature of these funds would not be detected. And that's why concealment money laundering really differs from promotional money laundering, because there is the difference of the concealing of the funds in order to
truly... And I'm right that you're only charging the part that they sent abroad. You're not charging the part that they kept.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So in that sense, you're only charging sort of what was left over for the foreign co-schemers.
That's correct. All of the co-schemers took their cut here in the United States before the money was transmitted.
And presumably covered their expenses for running this operation through their cut.
Yes, Your Honor. That's what the evidence in the record suggests, is that all of the money was taken out here, that the co-schemers were paid for their services.
I want to go on to the gun. And in Mr. Fichette's case, you seem to want to extend to wire fraud the presumption that we use in drug cases, that when a gun is stored with the drugs, of course, we have all sorts of cases that say that guns are tools of the drug trade. But do we have even one case saying that guns are tools of the wire fraud trade? Wire fraud, by its very nature, is usually carried out in a non-confrontational way. I am really wary of extending the principle to the wire fraud context, and I don't see what much else you have tying the gun to the crime. I mean, you know, this is a guy that likes to wave a gun around, but I'm really worried about what your argument here.
Your Honor, the government is not...
Which, of course, the district court will watch.
Sure. Your Honor, the government is not intending to suggest that the presumption should be carried across from the drug context to the fraud context.
But you said in your... you said at some point that it's common knowledge that criminals use guns to protect themselves and their loot. And I have the same concern Judge Rovner's expressing. I can't... It's not common knowledge, as far as I know, that people who conduct scams on eBay or over the Internet use guns.
What we're saying here is that the location, while not a presumptive fact, is a highly relevant fact. And the fact that the gun was found in a secret compartment along with Paquette's tools of the trade, the alias identification documents that were so crucial to this trade.
Maybe that's just where he keeps things that he doesn't want other people to see. Why do we have to think that the gun was used in connection with...
I think the evidence here was sufficient that it was not clear error for the judge to find that
this
was used.
Well, that's what we're asking. You can think that, but we have to decide if we think that, too.
Well, the location of the gun being found along with these alias identification documents, which were the tools of the trade and which were highly valuable.
So you have nothing but location, basically.
There's also the fact... I'm sorry, Judge. There's also the fact of the nature of the scheme and the fact that they were trading in large sums of cash.
Well, that's going to be every case.
It's not every case that...
It's going to be most federal cases.
In this case, however, there was a large quantity of cash that Paquette was trading back and forth.
But you have no evidence that he's taking the gun with him to the Western Union offices or that he's standing there as the security man as other people go into the Western Union offices. That kind of evidence, I would think, would be pertinent to people walking out of a Western Union with a lot of cash on their person. But that's the evidence that's not here.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is no evidence to that effect in the record. What there is evidence of is the location of the weapon and the fact that Paquette used the weapon to create a certain image to those around him, an image of Tony Montana, a bravado.
But some people do that. I mean, I can think of lots of my friends in Texas who go around with guns, and, you know, they're tough guys, right? You know.
That image and the fact that he was going to use the gun to protect one of his co-schemers, combined with the location of the gun, does provide sufficient evidence upon which the court could have found. And
well, but your opponent argues, Ms. Winston, and in the brief that they filed, argues that this friend, that the protection of the friend wasn't in any context that necessarily related to this crime. Maybe it was just a friend that he was protecting.
That's correct, Your Honor, but Schneider was serving a dual purpose. He was Paquette's friend, but he was also a member of the crew that Paquette was supervising.
So, but what's the evidence that it was the crew membership that caused Paquette or Fichetti or however he pronounces his name?
There is no evidence to
so
tie
there's
that,
no
Your
evidence.
Honor.
We so would have location.
We would concede that, but the combination of the comments, Schneider's testimony, and the location of the weapon does provide evidence that this gun was used in connection with the fraud. Again, it was used to protect, it was kept with the tools of his trade.
Ms. Simdahl, do you find anything at all odd about Mr. Fichette's sentence?
In what regard, Your Honor?
In the length.
Mr. Fichette did receive a significant sentence. He received 324 months. However, he also was one of the leaders of this large scheme in the United States, which resulted in harm to thousands of victims and millions of dollars worth of loss over a significantly long period. He recruited individuals into this scheme. He had a whole large crew working for him. Even Schneider and Vega were recruiting additional individuals at Fichette's behest.
He's the only one that went to trial, isn't he?
That's correct, Your Honor. I would like to move on to Mr. Demetriou before I run out of time and address his arguments today. The government would contend that Mr. Dimitru has waived the issue of the scope of his jointly undertaken criminal activity. He did not raise this issue below, and additionally, it has not been raised in his appellate brief. As to reasonable foreseeability, I would first contend that Studley is not a case dealing with reasonable foreseeability, but instead a case that deals with scope, an issue which has been waived. This court has also routinely distinguished Studley when considered at length and has not required district courts to follow only those factors in making determinations of jointly undertaken criminal activity. Additionally, Mr. Dimitru wants to be sentenced only on his own conduct. However, he was involved in a large-ranging scheme with multiple individuals, and the individual's conduct was foreseeable to him. The government employed a limiting principle below and only sought to hold him accountable for certain co-schemers' conducts with whom he was closely associated.
So, it's not ipsy-dixit. If you're going to say other people's conduct was reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Dimitru, you have to explain why. You know, he was going to the Western Union with them, or he sat down and planned behavior with them. What did he do with them that allows the inference that their acts were reasonably foreseeable, and whose acts?
To begin with, the conduct of Hahn and Malaman were certainly reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Dimitru. Hahn was Dimitru's either cousin or very close friend from another country, and Dimitru actually recruited Hahn into the scheme. The two shared rides to currency exchanges together when receiving fraud proceeds, and Dimitru also transferred proceeds of the fraud that he had obtained into Hahn's bank account and into the custody of Hahn and his wife. Malaman was also significantly connected to Dimitru because Dimitru delivered fraud checks that had come from the fraud scheme and from victims of this fraud scheme, to Malaman, and he did not get his cut of those fraud proceeds until they had cleared Malaman's account. Those two individuals alone, combined with Dimitru's own conduct, add up to over $527,000 worth of loss and 255 victims. That number right there puts us above the cutoff line in the guidelines for the amount of loss and number of victims for which Dimitru was ultimately held accountable. There are also other co-schemers he was found responsible for, and that would be Cerna and Fiquette. Those were two leaders of the scheme who directed Dimitru's conduct. They were basically his bosses. And by following,
but often underlings don't know everything that the boss is doing. The other way around, maybe the boss knows everything the underling is doing, but I'm not sure that's a two-way street.
But there's evidence in the record that they were connected, not only because they were directing him, but in other ways. He served on a crew with these individuals. He admitted they directed his conduct by providing him with alias identification documents, documents which were also provided to others in the scheme, and that he shared rides with Fiquettes when traveling to currency exchanges to pick up fraud proceeds. He admitted that in his plea agreement. The two of them only added up to $96,000 worth of loss that was added on to the $527,000 worth of loss that he's already addressing through Hahn, Malaman, and himself. And the reason being was that the government sought to only hold him accountable for their conduct in picking up proceeds and not by way of them to try to swoop in a whole larger conglomerate of the individuals that they were directing. And finally, there were four additional individuals for whose conduct he was held accountable, and that was Alexandru, Nanu, Penitescu, and Salem. They were all individuals who participated on Cerna's crew with Dimitru, and checks in the alias names of Alexandru, Nanu, and Penitescu were deposited into his account, an account that he had used to clear fraud proceeds. The combination of all of that information provides more than sufficient evidence for the district court to have found that their conduct was reasonably foreseeable to Dimitru. And just one point I would like to clear up, because it's raised in the appellant's brief, is that the government limited the time period for which Dimitru was liable for the conduct of others to the exact time period that he was participating in the scheme. He was not held liable for anyone's conduct after the date at which he stopped participating in the scheme. And finally, because I see I'm getting a little bit short on time, I just want to briefly address Mr. Panitescu's arguments. It's the government's position that the issue of concurrent versus consecutive is contained within the appellate waiver that's in his plea agreement. The appellate waiver covers any sentence within the maximum, and that does not mean it covers only the length of the sentence. It covers the sentence imposed here. What he's really seeking is to do an end run around his 11C1C agreement, and the court below would not permit this. Moreover, even if the court were to consider the issue below, there was more than sufficient evidence that Panitescu had fully served his sentence on the Malamin case. In addition to the document from the Bureau of Prisons, there was his own admission that he had fully served all 19 months on the Malamin sentence. That admission was made during the sentencing hearing.
But I think the point is, Mr. Brindley's making anyway, is that it's not really up to him whether he's served all 19 months. This is something that can only come from the Bureau of Prisons, and it didn't come from the Bureau of Prisons in the way that it should have.
It's possible that a letter should have arrived from the Bureau of Prisons, but that does not make a sentence undischarged. A letter stating a fact or not stating a fact doesn't mean that the underlying fact is not true.
But you can't argue that the Bureau of Prisons has never made a mistake and kept somebody in too long, because we know, in fact, that that's not true. People file 2241s. They file other kinds of claims if there's been a miscalculation of the length of their sentence and they're being detained longer than the judgment authorized.
Should the Bureau of Prisons make such a mistake, it does not mean that the person's sentence was not discharged on the proper date. It simply means that the Bureau of Prisons made a mistake and kept them past their date of discharge. The Bureau of Prisons can't keep someone longer and simply say, but we never gave them a letter, they weren't discharged. It would be an error to keep them past their discharge date, but it would not mean that the discharge date was not a fixed date in time. And that's when the sentence is fully served. Based on this court's reasoning in Cruz and other prior precedents, a sentence is discharged when it's fully served, and that was the case here. Unless there are no further questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Zendel. Mr. Brindley?
With respect to the question of whether the sentence was discharged, what I would add here is that If a defendant is kept in custody longer than he is supposed to be, there's no meaningful way in which you can say his sentence has been discharged. And in fact, in Cruz, this court talked about discharge being when someone is released from custody, which is the point that we've made in our brief. With respect to the appellate waiver, it is our position that when you construe the language strictly against the government, as is required, and you're talking about the sentence in this case, we're not contesting the calculation of the sentence. We're contesting only the judge's determination about the nature of a separate sentence in a separate case, a determination that we believe was in error. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brindley. Mr. Lopez?
Please, the Court, Your Honors. Again, as I noted in United States versus Andonigi, which is at 221 F 3rd 1020, 1B1.3 A1B. I think it's a two-step analysis, but I think that you can't really waive either one because you need to look at both of them. And although the trial counsel in the lower court didn't discuss the jointly undertaken criminal activity, that she did address the actual reason foreseeable to the defendant. It's a two-step process. So, again, we're saying that the court should look at both of these. And under the Saleem case, the judge didn't make sufficient findings of fact in this case in order to support that the undertaken criminal activity was reasonably foreseeable to the defendant. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lopez. Ms. Winston?
To focus on the money laundering conviction, and focusing particularly on this case, the way the government charged the case, which when they charged wire fraud conviction, the last leg of that conviction involved the transfer of the proceeds to Romania. In addition, they used that last leg to charge Mr. Fischetti for money laundering. That is a merger problem, which was addressed in Santos, Scialaba, and this court's Santos holding. Based on that, we think it's plain error that they convicted him for transferring proceeds and not proving net profit, and that his conviction should be vacated.
Thanks. Thank you, Ms. Winston. Our thanks to all counsel and to those defense counsel who were appointed. You have the additional thanks of the court for accepting the responsibility and carrying it out ably. Thank you. Okay.